Welcome to the Brown Posey Press Show, part of the Books Big Network, a program dedicated to independent and self-published authors. This show will examine new and unique works of literature, learn about their creators, and discuss the industry. And now your host, Tori Gates.
Welcome to this special edition of the podcast, The Voices of Cleveland Concoction. Last year, I traveled to Aurora, Ohio for this annual event, also known as CleCon. While there, I got some short interviews with many of the fellow authors who appeared, sat on panels, and promoted their works. This year, we did it again, and there will be two different podcasts. In this one, we'll talk with some of the authors about their works and what brought them here. First up, Rami Unger, author of novels and short stories, including Rose and the soon-to-be-published The Pure World Comes. He lives in Columbus, Ohio.
When I write our horror stories, horror and dark fantasy, and they tend to be a little weird, very interesting concepts, like, for example, my novel Rose is about a young woman who's turned into a plant-human hybrid, and that's just the start of her problems. Another one of my books is about a maid who goes to work for a mad scientist. Think Frankenstein and Crimson Peak had a baby together.
Wow.
Yeah, they're very interesting and just very unusual ideas for stories that I just write out, and people tend to like them.
Is that your style? Do you just write out? Do you do any like specific planning, or is it just as the mood takes you?
I'm a mega plotter. I'm actually working on a story right now, and I'm in the middle of finishing out the outline. It's about a 3D printer from hell.
And tell us about your influences. What were you reading growing up that obviously moved you this way?
Well, I wanted to become a writer after I read J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter. Back when we all thought he couldn't do any wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got into horror, my influences were mainly Stephen King and Anne Rice. After college, I got really into H.P. Lovecraft.
Mm-hmm.
And these days, I'm still very influenced by those authors, but also Robert Chambers, who wrote The King in Yellow. I love that book. I've been reading a lot of short stories by various different authors. If you can get a copy of The Best of a Horror or your anthology series, any volume, any year, you're in for a good time.
I have the Lovecraft anthology, and that's really cool. That's one of the good ones. Yeah, and that's an important thing, is to continue to read other authors. And I think some people have always been a little concerned, and I know I have, that I might steal from somebody. But at the same time, you sort of figure that out, don't you, as you write?
You mean take ideas and themes from other authors? Yeah, that's kind of just part of how literature works. As long as we're not like breaking copyright or stealing stuff that's patently in authors, then it's usually fine. But yeah, we influence each other. Sometimes we play in each other's sandboxes, so to speak. Like Lovecraft, he loved it when people wrote stories featuring his monsters, his characters.
Mm-hmm. And Arthur Conan Doyle was always rather impressed, and he was always interested when people did fan fiction of him and stuff like that. And he was really cool with most of it anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Even the ones that made Holmes out to be a bit more of adult.
Yeah, and these days you were also seeing reimagining of previous works. Like, I just read The Ballad of Black Tom by Victor Lavelle, which is a reimagining of The Horror at Red Hook by Lovecraft. Mwah, 5 out of 5.
Excellent. Well, one thing I would ask next is, in terms of coming out, this is your first CleCon and some of the other events, what kind of reactions you've been getting from folks?
What do you mean exactly?
Like, when people take a look at your books, do they ask questions? Do they get drawn in, do you think?
Typically, yeah, people check them out. They're like, oh, what's this about? Oh, a lot of it is me just trying to get people interested, though. Oh, and occasionally I do get, well, more than occasionally, a lot of the time I do get people very interested, and they're willing to buy a book. Whether or not they read it, though, that I can't say, but I do like to think they do. I've seen a lot of new reviews on my books lately, so I'm very happy to see that people are reading them and enjoying them.
Right. Last question. I usually ask people this. If somebody comes to you with a story idea, what do you give them? What's your best piece of advice?
You mean they just want to know what the best thing they can do to write it out themselves?
Yeah, what would you say to them?
Carve out the time to write, because there's no time fairy that's going to come down and be like, bippity-boppity-boo, here's 2 hours to work on that novel. You need to you need to make that time happen, and even if it means cutting out other things you could be doing. I mean, you don't want to cut back on sleep, but at the same time, you do want to, like, maybe do something other than watch Law & Order or reruns or whatever.
Find out more about Rami at RamiUngarTheWriter.com. Up next, from the greater Cleveland area, David F. Balog, author of works that include The Necromancer's Sorrow and one of the founders of Owl Talon Press. What has brought you back to CleeCon and your friend on your shoulder here?
Well, I've always loved Cleveland Concoction. I used to come here as a gamer quite often before the pandemic. During that time, I became an author, and I am now a publisher. So now I'm spending most of my time in Author's Alley instead of the game room.
Yeah, I'm trying not to stay in the room all that much because it's like I have other things I could do, and I have to also learn to get out and walk around. We were just talking about that.
Well, yeah, there's definitely that too. The more time you're spending in the room, the more you can promote your books. But in the meanwhile, there's a lot to look at, a lot of wandering around to do.
Exactly that. Tell us about your latest work and what you're going to be sort of promoting and that kind of thing.
Recently I released Necromancer's Sorrow, the second book in my trilogy, and about three quarters of the way done writing Necromancer's Grief to finish the trilogy. Necromancer's Sorrow is the further adventures from Necromancer's Lament of Mithran and his friends as they grow into out of their teenage years into early adulthood, getting into first relationships, which it's so much fun writing that much cringe. And they've also discovered at some point that people have stopped dying or are dying very slowly. So they take it upon themselves to find a way to get to the land of the dead to find out why everything's out of balance.
Okay, so for those who don't know, take us back to the beginning of Mithran and his friends and what brought them on this journey.
The entire trilogy is written as his memoir, so I was looking at his family life before magic discovers him, his apprenticeship, and then the journeys that takes him on. So many books I read when I was younger would have, you know, the great old wizard finding a young apprentice, and then next chapter is 20 years later where a young apprentice is now a great wizard of their own. I said, well, how did he grow up to be that way? How did he learn magic? What happened to him in the meanwhile? So I couldn't find it, so I wrote it.
That's cool. And isn't it interesting, like, when you write that first one, and then it just, there's more to tell, and then it just keeps going. How long a series do you think you have?
It's just going to be a trilogy. I actually wrote the epilogue before I finished book two, just because of other authors of recent times that have either died in the midst of a long series or are sitting on piles of cash from HBO and can't sit down and actually write anymore. So I wanted to give a definitive ending to my book in case something should happen, because, you know, things happen. You know, life isn't permanent. So I did that, but it's going to be a trilogy. I will have other stories in that world. One of the characters from book two I fell in love with, and I want to write my Alice in Wonderland story for her, to see what she was like before her mind kind of broke.
Right.
And I
right.
have a series of short stories that take place during the trilogy. Since the entire thing is written from the main character's perspective, there's a lot that happens that he's not aware of or that he's not involved in. So I wanted to write other stories as well that he just wasn't there for.
Okay. Tell us about your influences. Now, you say you came here first before you started writing, but what were you reading leading up? What brought you along this way?
Oh, I read everything. At age 12, I joined the science fiction fantasy book club, and so I was always getting new stuff. And some, cool. You know, whether it was anthologies, whether I was reading the David Ennings Belgariad, if I'm reading Asimov, if I'm reading Heinlein, love my Heinlein. Yep. And just meeting all kinds of new authors as they popped up in the mailbox. I went, oh, this is a fun one. Oh, this is a fun one. Oh, that one's not so great. I can just put that on the shelf and I won't get their books again. But, yeah, I read everything. And then I married an English major. So between the two of us, I think we've got about 3,000 volumes.
Wow.
We have our own library.
That's cool. And now you say, are you a self-publisher? You say you are a publisher.
I started with another publisher, and two of us left to form our own company, kind of a daughter company to Rock Hill Publishing. He gave five of us our start in 1 year, and we were very grateful for that. And what we wanted to do was free him up to find new authors while we started another company so that we could also find new authors and follow his example of bringing, you know, giving new authors a new voice and a new opportunity. So we started Owl Talon Press last June.
Okay. And I assume that the fellow on your shoulder is your CEO?
Yeah, she's our CFO. This is Tessalia. She is a character in my novels, and she's a short-eared owl. The one that's on my shoulder is actually stuffed and manufactured because a real owl would just, you know, well, first of all, she would poop down my back. And second of all, with all of the shows that we do and all of the people running around and the sounds and everything, it would just be too stressful for an owl to be able to sit on my shoulder all day long. Her talons would just dig deeper and deeper into my shoulder. And it would be uncomfortable for both of us at that point.
Well, in terms of running your own small press, running your own business, that must be a daunting challenge and an interesting one, maybe like an exciting one?
Yes, all of the above. Starting it off was daunting and exciting. There was definitely a learning curve and figuring out, all right, what steps do I need to take, figuring out how to use Ingram Spark and, you know, uploading files and getting the right size, figuring out the cover art and getting the right DPI and all of that.
Yep.
Was.
I've been through that.
So once I got that figured out, it's like, all right, it's been pretty smooth since then. Yeah, now I'm meeting new authors and other authors. We've taken on two authors over the winter, so we're still in the process of editing and getting them new book covers. They were self-published before, and they said, oh, can we publish with you? I went, okay. So my partner and I, we went through their books and go, all right, this is good. This meets our brand. It's in good condition. Just needs a little bit of editing and updating, and we'll be ready to go with it. So,
is there a way to define your brand?
Right now, we're pretty much focused on fantasy because we're just still trying to build our foundation. We will expand into other areas at some point. Plus, there are other things I want to write besides fantasy. So, you know, if I'm going to expand my own, then that's going to also help expand the brand.
Mm-hmm.
So it, but, you know, as, you know, again, we haven't been going that long, so we want to build a solid foundation before we pick up everybody and go all more directions. And, you know, I'm way behind on my writing because of the time I've been spending editing lately.
I understand that feeling. Well, last piece of advice that you could give, and maybe the best piece you could give, is to a prospective author. What would you tell them about a project they've got in mind and how to proceed?
Just sit down with it. Enjoy the process. Whatever your process is in your writing, and if you can write every day, do it. If you can't write every day, daydream about it. Think about your writing, even if you're not actually physically doing the work. Find the way that works best for you, whether it's outlining to a large degree and figuring everything out, if it's just writing as your muse directs, whether it's handwriting, laptop, typesetting, if you have the inclination for that, whatever makes your art, whatever makes your heart happy while you're doing your art, that's the important part. The rest of its details.
Find out more at davidfbalog.com. Next is Becca Lynn Mathis, author of the Trials of the Blood series.
This is actually my first author appearance as a guest at a con, so this is really exciting for me, and really just really neat to get to mingle with everybody and to be on panels and talking about my books and my stories and talking about kind of all the things that come along with being an author.
Mm-hmm. And what got you to start? What was the thing that said to you, I want to do this, I want to tell these stories?
Oh, man, these stories have been with me for years, and I've been, like, trying to write them a little bit. I've always just kind of been a writer. I wrote in high school, and I had a fantasy novel that I shelved. I don't know if I'll ever get back to it. But these stories just kind of, they came to me, like in dreams and bits and pieces, and then I put myself into them, and it was kind of ways to tell a little bit of my own story while also telling stories about people that aren't really me, and a little bit of escapism. And the world is a little bit too real, and I like writing a little bit outside of that.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your current work.
So I'm currently working on the next book of my urban fantasy series. Let's see, it's called A Place to Change. The first book is called A Place to Run. A Place to Change is actually a love story between two alpha werewolves and how they come together and how that, what they have to do with their pack, and one of them just is not really interested in love, and the other one didn't ever think that it was going to happen for him, and so it's really interesting to see these two kind of come together and go, oh, hey, that kind of works. We kind of work, don't we? And it's just a really fun story.
And what kind of reading did you get inspired by throughout your life?
Oh, man, honestly, my two biggest influences are probably Patricia Briggs and Jim Butcher. The Dresden Files are just some of my favorite books in general, and then the Mercy Thompson series by Patricia Briggs was heavily influenced. In fact, so much so that when I met Patricia Briggs at a conference, I was like, please don't read my first book, because I read them side by side, and there's a lot of things that are similar.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really fun, though. She's beautiful and wonderful, and she was like, no, you can tell the same thing when I'm with my books. So I thought that was really gracious of her.
That's cool. And do you have a writing style? I mean, it's like, how do you define what you write? Like, do you have a specific narrative style or writing style that just sets you apart?
Yes and no. I write pretty conversationally. I tend not to bog down a whole lot in details. I give you kind of some general, like, tent poles of what's going on in a scene, and I kind of let your imagination do the rest of the work. And I think one of the things that kind of marks my work a little bit different from everybody else's is I actually rely heavily on not stereotypes, but like tropes that you know and archetypes that you know, and like the If there's a lady at a diner, you know, she's going to have, like, the pencil in her hair. And now I don't need to tell you a whole lot more. You've already got the vision in your head of what she looks like.
Yep.
And that's kind of how I move through a lot of my stories, is telling little bits to get you where you need to go.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of reaction have you gotten so far?
Honestly, really positive. It's been really, it's been shockingly positive. Because my stories are much more personal and they're not big world-ending kind of stories. They're like, the first book is about a girl trying to figure out what it means to be a werewolf, and to see the reaction from some of my readers where they're like, this is one of my favorite stories. I love this story so much. I'm just like, I'm kind of blown away, because I knew that when you write something that you like, you're going to find somebody else that likes it too. But it was really interesting and really just mind-blowing to see somebody really just latch onto it as much as I did.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, is like, our books are always in search of readers. And I guess the next thing I must ask is, we were on a panel a little bit earlier discussing mental health.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you're willing to discuss, but you and I both kind of dealt with some different issues. And is that therapy? Is that a part of the creative process for you? Do you think it's an addition?
I think it's an addition. Definitely, I explore a lot of my own personal demons and everything in what I write, and tease out pieces of my personality through my characters. And figure out a little bit more about what I want out of the world and what the world's giving back to me and how I'm reacting to the world. And that comes out, I think, in my writing. And it's just been really, it's been very interesting to see the similarities and to watch, as I'm writing this character, realizing, oh, this is how my life is kind of going too. Oh, I can kind of see. And even though they're in an obviously completely fictional world, I can still see enough of the similarities that I can go, oh, I need to make some changes too. And I can make changes that help me along my journey a lot better.
And it makes it relatable, that sort of thing. And how difficult is it to work with an editor? I mean, you've got to have at least one.
Yes. Yeah. I worked... The editor for my first book, I ended up parting ways with and going with a different editor. Finding an editor that really gets your work is really the key. And finding somebody that can give you feedback in a way that you can actually use it is actually a little bit more of a challenge than I thought it was. My first editor could do things like tell me when something was wrong, but wasn't really great at helping me understand what I needed to do to fix it.
Right.
The editor that I work with now is really great about going, so this is working, but I don't think it's hitting the way that you're trying to get it to hit, and you might want to try teasing out a little bit of this part of this story or this part of this scene to make it hit the way that you want it to.
Okay. And where can we find your work?
I'm online at BeccaLynnMathis.com. You can find all my work on Amazon and of course, messaging me directly through my website, I can get signed copies out to people.
Great. What's the one piece of advice you give to someone who's got an idea but doesn't know how to move forward with it?
Just put your butt in the chair and write. Free write until you've got words going, and then keep going.
You can find Becca at BeccaLynnMathis.com. When we come back, more of the voices of CleeCon on the Brown Posey Press Show.
Explore Sunbury Press Books and find the work of talented authors in many genres. Ars Metaphysica is our spiritual, new age, and metaphysical imprint. Check out Pettengill's Perfect Fortune Teller and Dream Book by Pelletiah Pettengill, The Space Between by Judith Bowen, and works by Kareem El Kusa, including The Phoenician Code. Find out more by clicking on the Books tab at sunburypress.com.
Welcome back. A former guest of the Brown Posey Press Show is Marcus Cook. We've discussed in a previous BookSpeak Network podcast about short stories. Since then, Marcus has written stories about his protagonist, Ava Edison. We learn more about what Marcus has in store for Ava and her ghostly counterpart, Mary. Since I last saw you, you have a new novel that has been completed and out. Tell us about this story, A Chance in Hell.
A Chance in Hell is a story about Ava Edison, who is a former Navy SEAL. She's a professional thief and a single mom. Her partner in crime is an 18th century ghost named Mary, and she's hired to go into Buddha's hell to bring back a magic stone.
Okay, now we have talked about Ava in the past. I think you've had her in some of your stories.
Yeah, I've done Ava Edison and the Burning Man. It was a short story, very first short story I ever wrote, like got published.
Mm-hmm. And she's just kind of stuck around, hasn't she?
She is. She's a fun character, and I'm glad I got to extend her story to really get it out there.
It was interesting. I was just doing a panel about creating the unforgettable, enduring character. Tell us about where Ava came from and what influenced you to bring her out, and tell us a little more about what she's really about.
Ava actually started in a short story contest for the New York Short Story Contest. I had to write a character that had to be at a dock, and had to do with a paint gun. And for some reason, I woke up that morning, and Ava Edison was name was in my mind. And she, in the short story, she's just kind of more of an action heroine, very vanilla. It was a fun, strong character I really liked. When I was thinking about writing a short story, I saw this and I said, let me do Ava, really evolve her. And that's where she really became a widow. She's a widow, being a single mom now of a 10-year-old. And I brought the ghost in the short story about Marion, and I brought her in briefly. thinking, you know, I'll just tease it a little bit, and people loved Mary. They wanted to hear more about Mary. And so when I was thinking of a novel, I'm like, you know, this would be perfect, and I could create, grow the story with Ava and Mary and their relationship and how it began. And I mean, to be with it, only be able to, it's like Sixth Sense, she only sees Mary. So.
And Mary is such an intriguing character because she's from the past and she's hanging about.
Yeah, you know, for hundreds of years. And Ava actually helps her in a hospital. Like, she calls for help, you know, because Mary's reliving one of her former relatives dying. And nobody's hearing her say, hey, my, you know, my niece needs help. And Ava heard her. And now, she saw the niece, but nobody could help her. But at least when she's trying to help, Mary kind of clung on.
And there's that relationship that sort of has endured and has gotten so much stronger. And, I mean, it's always interesting to have, like, the ghost. And does Mary act like a conscience, or is she sometimes, is she either the angel or the devil, or is she both?
Oh, definitely both. More the devil. like, she doesn't understand, you know, she still lives in the 18th century in her mind. She isn't caught up to how people are supposed to act in the 21st century. Especially when it came to American Indians, and the names she called American names were inappropriate. And,
right.
But it's fun to hear the banter between Ava and Mary because of this. And there's a lot of banter between the two.
That's cool. And taking a look at the evolution of it, you know, you were talking about using her in short stories. What brought you to the novel? What brought you to say, I can now take the step forward? Because we've talked about the short stories.
I always wanted to write a book, and I thought Ava was the strongest in my head. The voices were really there. And I thought Ava and Mary would be just intriguing characters in literature that people would enjoy and really like and read and continue to want to read.
Mm-hmm. And I know we've talked about this before, but for the benefit of those who do not know you yet, what about some of your influences that you know, prompted you to write, that propelled you forward in that?
Elmer Leonard and Dean Koontz are two of my biggest, and I think that's what almost, throw in a little bit of Clive Cussler and you get Ava Edison, I mean, perfectly.
So the female Dirk Pitt a little bit.
Yes.
I read Clive Cussler in high school. Good
female
stuff.
With a little odd Thomas in her.
That's really cool. And how about that process of having to stretch Ava and Mary out and getting to the big, to, you know, the full length thing? How difficult was it to transition into thinking really long form, thinking a long storyline?
Very. It was very. I wrote the first draft and it was like 15,000 words, and they're like, you need 60 at least.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what? But, you know, my wife told me, you know, hey, honey, just write. And then, you know, we'll just edit down. So I wrote a lot of stuff, and then you just cut from there. You know, it was too much.
And how long a process has this been?
3 years.
Okay. And you have pitched it, and are you getting any feedback right now from any of the prospective publishers, agents, etc.?
But I got one from one publisher saying, you know, with a long list, that was nice. It was a long list of things that needed to be fixed. And that was, like, I sent out the very first, like, it was done, and I edited, and I sent it out, like, without really re-editing. So I had a lot of notes. And then I just got a letter. I had sent the wrong copy of the novel, which, just excitement, I clicked the wrong one. So I resent it with a letter saying, hey, I'm sorry, you know, here it is. And they actually said, listen, we looked it over just briefly what it is, and we definitely will put it back into the pile, and we want to read it and let you know from there.
So, excellent.
So at least they were intrigued so enough to say, hey, you screwed up, but we still want to read it.
And the other thing, too, is you got feedback. You got some genuine feedback, and I have gotten so little of that. I've gotten on occasional little things of, like, you know, such and such character, make her more dynamic. And I'm like, she will be, she is.
Right.
And it's like, but at the same time, at least you get that and you don't just get completely smacked down. I've gotten that too.
You know, and when it was the short story, I got the most, when I wrote her as a short story, I got the most, like, Amazon reviews. Like, people actually, I mean, there's 16 stories in there and people were talking about Ava. Like, 5-6 people were just about Ava Edison. I was like, wow, that's really cool that they actually pulled my story aside and said, you know, how much they enjoyed it.
That's great then. Well, I am certain you're going to be picked up somewhere. Last question of when somebody is talking to you about an idea and they don't know how to proceed, what's the best advice you give to a prospective writer?
I tell them to just write it. Just sit down. And start it. Maybe put down on the paper. At least it's a beginning. And you go from there.
You can find Marcus on Facebook and Instagram, among other places. Next, S.A. Ferguson, who is preparing her first novel for publication.
This is the book is titled The Elder Sequence. And it's the first book in the Leaders of Eleusimoic series. And it is, this universe is in a faraway galaxy, but we have Mira, who is the main character from planet Earth, and she doesn't have a way back to Earth. And so she's been living on this planet with the Eleusimoicans, and they are in interaction with other worlds in their kind of galactic vicinity, but the story largely focuses and centers on Eleusimoic.
Okay, and what is Eleusimoic? What is this?
This is the name of the world, the primary world, and the Eleusimoicans are on that world, and they are like very technologically advanced. They have the capability to build wormholes, but there's still some kind of hang-ups in the technology. So it's not really... they can create wormholes, but they're not passable. And yet, somehow, Mira, our main character, has been able to pass through a wormhole and survive, and they don't know why.
Mm-hmm. And who is Mira, or who was she before she ended up here?
She was an anthropologist on Earth and was planning to study some cultures in Asia. And but she ended up going through the wormhole, but she doesn't quite remember how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And but now on the world of Eleusimoic, she is a warrior, an officer, and the second in command of the people of Eleusimoic.
And was this, without giving it all away, was this something she dropped into, or did she somehow rise up the ranks quickly with her knowledge and her intelligence?
Well, kind of both, actually. So when she went through the wormhole, her now spouse was one of the scientists on the team.
Ah.
And he's also the current leader of the people. So he's both a scientist and a politician, in a way. Oh. And so she kind of landed in the lap of these powerful people. And they saw her talent early, and she got kind of ushered into this position.
And her whole thing is still trying to get back, even with all this.
I think possibly in the back of her mind that's there, even though she knows it's not feasible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And where does this come from? The cover is fantastic, by the way.
Thanks.
I thought that was... It is... The cover makes the book. And that certainly did. Where are your influences? What did you read early on? What brings you to this?
You know, it's really hard to say because I didn't read a whole lot of sci-fi growing up.
Mm-hmm.
It's really been a more recent interest of mine. It's really difficult to say. I have these ideas that have kind of been ruminating, and I started the process in full force during NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month, mm-hmm. several years ago, and came up with 50,000 words. And it's a completely different story now, but it got me started on exploring this.
Mm-hmm. And what were you reading? What were your authors and the kind of things you read, listened to, that sort of thing?
Well, I have a master's in English, so I've read a lot of like literature, mm-hmm. Like traditional literature. And so, you know, some of like Charlotte Bronte and that kind of thing. She's one of my favorite authors. I would say, though, like one of my favorite sci-fi authors is Ursula K. Le Guin.
Mm-hmm.
She's definitely, certainly the Left Hand of Darkness, which she wrote, is, I would say, a close like comp to the kind of ambiance, maybe, of the story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, with an English background and the deep background in literature, somewhere along the line, when did you get the opportunity, or when did you decide, I want to do this, the NaNoWriMo thing or whatever?
I don't know what prompted me. I think it just got to this point where these ideas have been circulating in my head and I just need to start writing them down. Before that, I was writing short stories, but never really had a big intention to write a novel. And I think in school, as a professional English major, we were kind of discouraged from writing genre.
Really?
Writing, yeah. It's more of like a literary slant to that education. And that may depend on the professor.
And that could also be it's the perception too, I suppose, because I had very fortunately an English professor in college who was also an author and a poet, and he was a huge help to me. I am surprised he remembered me from the two classes I took with him, but it was, you always got the encouragement to try other things and to lean into other things, and well, if I may, we both were on a panel yesterday mm-hmm. discussing mental health and discussing it. I mean, I've always thought writing was really good therapy for me. It became that. I never essayed anything beyond a short story or a song or news copy. I had no idea that I had this in me. Mm-hmm. And you get that opportunity and suddenly begin to realize what an incredible feeling that is.
Mm-hmm.
How does it work for you that way? What do you get from that?
From the writing process?
Yeah.
I get this sense of being myself. You know, I get to express these ideas that are in my head. I get to explore things that I may have not otherwise explored. A tagline on my website says exploring worlds through writing, and unless I sit down to write, I don't know if I would be able to discover and explore these worlds.
And we discover about ourselves, don't we?
Yes, we certainly do. And that kind of has come later to me. I look back on some of my writing and I'm like, oh, I can see that trait or theme in my life just popping out there.
Mm-hmm. Somebody said this to me recently, and it was like, no matter what we do, a little of us shows up in every character. And I had consciously tried to keep myself out of the first couple of books that I wrote because I wasn't ready to share myself with other people. And then looking back on it, I was like, oh, there I am, the angsty 16-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to see that. But at the same time, it was like, okay, now I understand how I got here. Now I remember, and then I remembered what I went from to when I got to college and discovered broadcasting and discovered, yeah, you can do this. And I think my doings, whatever they are my therapy and have always helped me step forward. And do you feel like there's a growth in yourself as well as your writing as you progress and continue to work forward? Is that something that's a conscious effort?
I don't know how conscious it is. Maybe it's becoming increasingly so. But I do think writing provides an excellent exercise in discovering who you are and what your philosophies are on the universe. It's definitely a journey, and I love it.
Right. When is the book going to be available?
Well, it's going to be available this summer, 2024, and there's no date yet. But
and where can we find it when the time comes?
Well, for now, you can go to my website, saferguson.com, and you can subscribe to my newsletter for updates. And I'm also on social media at Aluzumoakin, which is Aluzumoakan. It's very long, but so you can follow there for updates, and I will let you know.
All right. And what's the one best piece of advice you can give to a prospective writer or somebody who's ready to take that step but not sure?
Don't let your perfectionism get in the way. Just get out there and start creating, and don't worry about what other people think.
Follow SA at saferguson.com. Two more voices when we return to the Brown Posey Press Show.
Sunbury Press Books brings you the work of independent authors from Pennsylvania and beyond. Check out Family Declassified by Catherine Finelli. If you're into baseball, Days of Reckoning by Ronald T. Waldo tells of the early 20th century glory days of the Pittsburgh Pirates. For politics, former Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor and Acting Governor Mark Single offers Seeking Truth in America. Find these and other great books at sunburypress.com.
Welcome back. We now hear from Shannon Eichhorn, an aerospace engineer and author. Shannon specializes in a certain type of writing, which I will let her describe.
So I'm writing a series with body-possessing aliens flying saucers in an underfunded secret government project. It takes place in the recent past, contemporary Earth, with big, expansive galactic alien empires.
And the name of this is?
The Project Black Book series. The first book is Rights of Use.
Okay. Tell us about some of the players in it. And who will we meet as we read this?
So one of the first people you meet is the Speaker of the House, Andrew Rockefeller, who finds that his daughter has been kidnapped. And for some reason, his wife says that she was, like, abducted by aliens off the street of their cul-de-sac. Well, this obviously can't be true. So he's trying to dig into it from the government perspective. What happened? Who knows about this? And who's going to tell him the real truth about where his daughter went?
Okay. And I am certain that his daughter and now Mr. Rockefeller is about to meet some interesting characters. What kind of, tell us about like the creation of the series, the creation of this universe. You say it's in just recent past, but there's obviously a lot more there.
There's a lot there. I've been working on this story on this series for 20 years. Wow. And on this universe for about 5 years less than that. I had the story put together with original characters and then needed to rebuild the universe. So I kind of took a look at how do I want to do this? You know, I know that I need to get these characters off Earth. Let's dig into the flying saucer mythos. And have you ever heard of Project Blue Book?
I have heard of it, yes.
Okay. So it's got an alternate history for Project Blue Book and the follow-on work.
Okay. Well, tell us where you got your inspiration for this. I always find that talking to people, what they read early on, what their parents read, that kind of thing must have been really formative. Tell us about that. Tell us what your interests are there.
So my dad got me into Dune. My dad in middle school read
Excellent.
A bunch of Star Wars Extended Universe stuff with me. Which was a blast. And then we got into the Stargate TV series, Stargate
yep.
SG-1. So it's a lot of that kind of all rolled together, but I was in middle school at the time, so it started with a middle schooler's perspective.
And when did you think that I can write this too, or I want to write my own kind of thing?
Eighth grade.
All right.
I was like, I can do anything. Nobody can stop me from doing this. I'm bored. Let's do it. Let's try.
And how did that go? Because I remember my earliest stabs at trying to write anything.
Hopefully nobody will see the first draft or the second draft or the fifth draft or the eighth draft. And it's too late for the ninth draft. People have seen it.
Okay. But, wow, it's like you were so into it then. And has that... whatever your work ethic might have been, has that translated into your adult life? Or
I think it largely has. You know, at the time I was writing in those like couple of minutes before the bell rings at classes and going home in the evening, writing on the bus, writing in the afternoons. It's a lot harder to do with my day job and with the things that I've studied since then. You know, I have good weeks when, you know, I can go home or go to a coffee shop and, like I said on the panel earlier, write 3,000 words in an evening. But that's not normal.
Well, and this is the thing too, is like, I've heard people, and I mean, it was kind of a joke, but some people took it very seriously about, oh, I write 5,000 words a day, and I'm like, but what's the quality of those 5,000 words?
I mean, it depends on how you think, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to judge the qualities of somebody's work based on the speed that they're writing.
Right.
But I know that I think very slowly. I think in a lot of tangents and then have to bring them all together, and that makes it slow. And I appreciate what Becca said earlier as well. I don't see the difference in the quality of my work based on writing speed, because when I write fast is when I'm in a flow and just when everything is coming together.
And that's the thing for me too, is I will, once I get started, I will just start rolling. And I sort of put it as a situation, there's periods where I'm not writing. Mm-hmm. And it's because I'm either busy or I'm just busy with other things, but often I'm editing the one that's coming up next. I'm editing one of my other works. But I always tell people, is just because you haven't written anything down doesn't mean you're not, because if you're thinking about your stories, your characters, you are writing, you're just writing in your head. Nothing wrong with that.
I find that there are a lot of times where, you know, I'll be on a roll for a while and I'll push for a while and then I'll kind of run myself into the ground with that.
Yeah.
And those follow periods in between, when, you know, times like now when I'm trying to get some other things in order in my life, or, you know, I'm waiting to hear back on revisions for one story. I've submitted another story to a critique group. I'm, you know, here promoting. The next time I sit down, or like a couple days after that, things are going to go really well. I'll have all these fresh new ideas and energy to take to the work.
And the thing we talked about too was the balance, mm-hmm. of, you know, giving ourselves the time to sort of decompress, take care of ourselves. And as we, I think, all agreed, it can be very hard when we are just on a roll and we just don't want to stop.
Right. And what I really like is giving myself permission to go back and forth and to not expect to have a continuous identical balance every day. You know, I want to ride that roll. I want to ride the rush. I love that part. I also love the part when, you know, I take some time to regroup and restore and read, because that's a good thing too, and take in other media to get an idea of what is the landscape of fiction right now? How is it changing? What's going on in different genres? And to be able to bring that perspective back to my work as well.
And yes, that's important, to read others and to watch other things. Well, where can we find this great work? Because this sounds really cool.
You can find links,
yeah.
on my blog at blog.shannoneichorn.com. That's blog.shannoneichorn.com. It's on Amazon, it's on Spotify, Chirp, Barnes & Noble Audio, Kindle Unlimited.
Cool. Well, last question I always ask people is, if you are approached or asked by someone about an idea they have, they're not sure how to proceed, what's the one good piece of advice you would give?
That they are the best person to write it.
Find out more at shannoneichorn.com. Our final guest on this podcast is Cliff Flint, a longtime musician and computer programmer. He discusses his historical comedy, Promised Rewards.
I'm a relatively new author with one novel and several short stories and anthologies out. What brought me to CleveCon was my little Honda, because it does that.
So does mine.
Yeah, nice about that. I came last year and I had a good time, so I figured I'd do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a good time.
That's good. Tell us about your novel.
Okay. Promised Rewards is a historical humor book, which kind of fits between the shelves, and nobody really knows where to put it. But the bologneum is that we have our main character, a bard, who sings about the great hero Sigurd. And then this guy comes up to him and says, "You sing about Sigurd. He's got blonde hair and an axe, and he's tall. And I'm tall, and I'm blonde hair, and I have an axe. So tell people I'm Sigurd, and they'll pay us better, and I'll share it with you."
Mm.
That last part kind of cinched the deal. And then it turns out that if you tell people you're a hero, they expect you to do heroic stuff. And to quote the bard for the last part was, "What do you mean, we?"
Tell us a little bit about what brought you to that part of, was it an interest in history? What got you to craft this kind of your own niche, really?
It was just an idea that I had for a short story. Mm-hmm. With just the idea that, you know, we'd make believe that we're heroes and play them up backwards. And I wrote a short story, threw it away. And then my wife did NaNoWriMo and found out that she had a bunch of writers living within a mile of us.
Oh, wow.
And she formed a writers group. And I said, well, I'll join. I'll just critique. I'm not going to actually write anything. And that lasted for 2 weeks. And they liked my story. So I wrote the follow-on to just continue the story. And then I ran out of short stories and had to make a novel out of it.
You transitioned. How easy was the transition from, say, the short story format to the big one?
Badly done,
okay.
To be honest. As novels go, this is a flawed novel because it is very episodic at the beginning. But all of the characters that are introduced at the beginning come together in the end. So I think people who have read it have all survived, I think. So, and it was fun to write, and it's been fun. People have liked it enough. I've written a sequel novel that's going through one of my writers' groups now and halfway through the third. My own background is I am a musician by hobby, not commercial. So they talk about write what you know. And especially when I started this, I had it in a vaguely D&D sort of a fantasy world, maybe sort of.
Okay.
And then as I worked on the story, I had to place it someplace real. So I finally decided on 9th century Great Britain because nothing happened then. it's before the big, before Norman the Conqueror and before the Danes came in even.
Yep.
So I could write a story about small people who didn't have any big events going on around them. And that was fun. That was good. And I ended up learning a lot about Great Britain and the history. But what I really know is how to work an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Bard does. So he does it way better than I ever do because I have time to think about what he needs to do.
So was the Bard based on you, or was there – how did he come about?
I try to make believe that he's not based on me.
Okay.
But, yeah, he's small. He's not a fighter. He's fast on his feet with a wit. But his primary way of getting out of a battle or out of a problem is run.
Okay.
And, yeah. Or rely on Sigurd, who is tall and blonde and has an axe.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of convenient.
But it's like it sounds like it's an odd couple, but they find a way to sort of get along, sort of thing.
Yes, and that is a lot of the plot for the first book, is them going from an uneasy alliance to a brotherhood,
mm-hmm.
and really believing in each other.
That's cool. I must ask, what do you play?
Guitar. I play a lot of folk music.
Okay.
That was what? When I graduated from college, I wanted to write in the worst way possible.
Right.
I did exactly that. But I also found fandom and found folk music, and the folk music crowd was a lot more accepting than the editors at Galaxy and Analog.
Right, right.
So that gave me the ego boost that I wanted, and it also meant that I spent like 40 years, practicing poetry.
Oh.
And learning my craft of how to make the words work and tell a story concisely, because you only got 3 minutes before people get bored.
I did exactly the same thing in the late 80s. I picked up a guitar primarily because I had written some really bizarre poetry that I thought might be songs. And I didn't play as long or as much, but my music has always come back into my books because music has driven a lot of my stories. So it works really well. It's not uncommon, but it's like I can write my own pieces that go into it, and it feels a lot better when you do that.
Yeah. And you don't violate any copyrights.
Well, at least you're not paying anybody. And sometimes artists have been really cool. They've been like, oh, you want to use my lyrics for this? And I'll explain it to them. And they're totally cool with it. There were a couple like, yeah, kind of would like, you know. And I'm like, sure. I'm all, you know, if I can do it, I pay the license fee. It's all well and good. In other cases, if not, with the Sweet Dream series, I was like, okay, I have to do that to a certain extent, but it's going to cost me. So I'm like, I'll write my own lyrics. And so I did. I wrote my own songs, and more fulfilling.
Yeah. One of my wife's novels, we have a character who is a musician in it, and working in a sort of a futuristic Renaissance festival.
Mm-hmm.
And she sings songs from all eras. And we went to a lot of trouble. We found the best song to fit this scene.
Yep.
And then we found out about copyright and licensing mm-hmm. and had to go through and write new songs for all of those scenes so that, you know, something that would fit.
But it certainly seems to have all kind of advanced what you were doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It kept things going. It's a novel I want to rework one of these days and see if I can get it out into the great outside world.
Okay. And where is this now currently available?
Promise Rewards is available on Amazon or MythWorks website.
Okay.
Or at most cons in the Midwest.
And this sequel, is there, what kind of adventures could you let us know that our friends are going to find out about?
Okay, we finish up Promised Rewards with Bard realizing that he has sinned and needs penance.
Okay.
So we open up a simple penance with him getting assigned a penance of taking a bunch of attestations to Rome to see whether or not they can make a hermit into a saint.
Ah.
And being slightly stupid and slightly arrogant, he gets on the wrong boat. And he goes, they take him to Rome. New Rome. Constantinople.
Oh.
Because that is the Roman Empire in this period. Rome
yes.
is kind of overrun by the barbarians.
Wow.
And, of course, he arrives in chains because after we've taken your money for passage, we can sell you as a slave and double our profits.
Right. Last question I have is the one I usually ask most people. You probably got it in the writer's group. When somebody is not sure how to proceed, they've got an idea and they want to work with it, what's the best piece of advice you can give them?
Do it. There is no failure in screwing up. There is always failure in not accomplishing anything. I do woodworking also. My best pieces have hit the trash can at least twice.
Check out cflint.com to find out more. My thanks to Melissa Stasko and everyone who made Cleveland Concoction a success. I've always had a great time meeting authors, cosplayers, gamers, and all-around cool and fun people. Find out more about this event at clevelandconcoction.org. Until next time, I'm Tori Gates. Peace out.
You've been listening to the Brown Posey Press Show with your host, Tori Gates. Find his works, including Searching for Roy Buchanan, Call It Love, and Shake Hands with the Devil, along with more independent authors of fiction and nonfiction at sunburypress.com. Thank you for listening. This is the BookSpeak Network.